Chapter 6. The Early Days. The first 6 months after Bush took office on January 20, 2001, would be a crucial time for defining the president and his administration. Bush and his top advisors recognized the importance of achieving some early victories on signature policy items, especially tax cuts and education reform. They also wanted to portray the new president as a strong leader who could unite the American people and who had the necessary heft in foreign policy, one notable area of concern about Bush's leadership ability. At the same time, the tone set by the new administration would also be of great importance. Most Americans were more than ready for a return to civility in the national political discourse. They were weary of the excessive partisanship of the previous decade, ready to move beyond Bill Clinton's personal scandals and exhausted by the extended 2000 election period. But whether Washington was prepared to respond by working together in a spirit of bipartisan cooperation remained uncertain. During the campaign, Bush had tapped into the mood of the broad majority of Americans who were in or who leaned toward the vital political center. He had urged an end to the politics of anger and the beginning of a fresh start after a period of cynicism. Washington, Bush said, did not have to be a place of zero-sum politics with one winner and one loser. Now, at the outset of his presidency, it seemed to me that Bush was committed to making it happen. In his inaugural address, Bush returned to this campaign theme. America, at its best, matches a commitment to principle with a concern for civility. A civil society demands from each of us goodwill and respect, fair dealing, and forgiveness. Some seem to believe that our politics can afford to be petty because in a time of peace, the stakes of our debates appear small. But the stakes for America are never small. We must live up to the calling we share. Civility is not a tactic or a sentiment. It is the determined choice of trust over cynicism, of community over chaos. And this commitment, if we keep it, is a way to shared accomplishment. No one in the White House, including me, was naive about the difficulty of ending Washington's deep-seated partisan warfare in those early days. But I believe Bush was willing to make a concerted, sustained effort to rise above the destructive partisan squabbling and the distractions created by the Washington noise machine. Unfortunately, it would turn out otherwise. In looking back on the inner workings behind the White House's public performance during these early months, I've come to better understand some of the factors that would later contribute to the Bush presidency's veering off course. Those first few weeks were a flurry of chaotic activity. Everything was happening at once. I moved into my small downtown apartment halfway between the Capitol and the White House over inaugural weekend. The demands of transitioning into the White House as the principal deputy press secretary gave me little time to enjoy all the festivities. Like many others, I'd just packed up my belongings at the transition office the day before. In order to allow time for a quick cleaning and makeover, Joe Hagan, the new Deputy Chief of Staff for Operations, had suggested we wait until late Sunday before entering our West Wing offices. When I first stepped foot inside the building, a box of my personal belongings in my hands, it was definitely a moment when I was wowed. There would be many others during those first few weeks of the Bush administration, including when I drove home late at night after a long day of work in the West Wing, taking E Street along the South Lawn side of the White House. I glanced to my left, and there was the White House, the People's Mansion, glowing in the soft yellow radiance of the floodlights against the blackness of a Washington night. The sight never got old. On Monday, our first full workday, we hit the ground running. I was up at 5 a.m., reading the New York Times and Washington Post, the two newspapers that more than any others dictated the direction of the national media and shaped the national storylines. Then it was off to the White House, where I arrived before 7 a.m. There were a few early meetings to discuss press issues of the day and message strategy, followed by the press secretary's morning press gaggle and the afternoon briefing, the two public sessions that would become focal points of the day in my new role. The cycle quickly became routine, but never less than demanding, and never dull. Even at the outset, Iraq was looming in the background. That very first Monday, the New York Times, citing a new internal U.S. government intelligence estimate, ran a front-page story about Iraq rebuilding factories that the United States has long suspected of producing chemical and biological weapons, according to senior government officials. The Times called it an early test of Bush's pledge to take a tougher stance against Saddam Hussein than his immediate predecessor had. Iraq would continue to be a top issue of administration focus and media interest in months to come. The National Security Council met Iraq in early priority of the policy formulation process. As for that first day, with no new policy yet firmly in place, we simply told the press that the president expected Saddam Hussein to live up to his agreement with the United Nations that his regime not produce weapons of mass destruction. That same day, Bush issued a presidential memorandum addressed to the administrator of the U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID, instructing that the so-called Mexico City policy be reinstated. This policy, originally put in place by Ronald Reagan, stated that any non-governmental organization, NGO, receiving USAID funding could not perform or actively promote abortion as a method of family planning, with exceptions for rape, incest, and the life of the mother. It was an early signal to the president's social conservative base that his administration was strongly committed to supporting their causes. As planned, the president focused publicly on education reform in week one. We began the formal rollout on Tuesday, hitting the main elements of the initiative, including the requirement that states develop their own systems of annual testing to measure student progress, the increased flexibility provided in spending federal money, the provision of additional assistance for low-income schools, and the principle of offering school choice for students in schools deemed to be failing. Plenty of attention was paid to showing that the president was reaching out to Republican and Democratic members of Congress. The Congress was closely divided, but both houses were controlled by Republicans. The Senate was split 50-50, but Vice President Cheney had the tie-breaking vote, giving Republicans control, though they agreed to a power-sharing arrangement with Democrats. In the House, the breakdown was 221 Republicans to 211 Democrats, with two independents. Due to a handful of deaths and resignations, the numbers would fluctuate ever so slightly in the coming months. In the early weeks, Bush held a series of meetings with leaders in both parties to discuss top domestic priorities, including education, tax relief, his faith-based initiative, and a patient's bill of rights, what Bush termed front burner issues. We made a point of drawing attention to the bipartisan outreach. My first White House trip with President Bush was to the retreat for Democratic House members, held at a resort just outside Pittsburgh the first weekend in February. Bush had already attended the Senate's Democratic retreat. Clinton had never attended Republican retreats, so the move was given due notice in the media and credit for its bipartisanship by Democratic leaders. The event was not open to the press. The president began his remarks at the retreat by saying, "I'll do my best to change the tone of the dialogue in Washington. It is my hope that people can disagree in an agreeable way. One of the things I resolve to do is say, here's my position. I want to hear you out. Bipartisanship is going to require more than words to put forth good public policy, and I believe we're all here to do that." Then he added, "I ran on an agenda. That's what I'm here to talk to you about. I believe the right thing to do is to do what you said you were going to do during the campaign. The expectation is that nothing will get done because of the closeness of the election," he added, making it clear that he intended to prove that expectation wrong. "Part of coming here today is to tell you who I am and about my agenda, and listen to what you have to say." He then took several questions. The respected elder congressman Charlie Rangel of New York said in his unique voice, raspy yet oddly captivating, "Mr. President, you're good." He then remarked that it took a lot of political courage for Bush to come to the retreat and reach out to Democrats, and asked whether Bush would urge his party leaders to work across the aisle too. Bush replied that he was committed to taking the same message of civility to the Republican leadership.